Extending help. With the practice of doing no harm as your foundation, now you can cultivate concern for others. First, through the morality of individual liberation, we learn to control anger and the like. And now we can begin learning how to comfort and serve others. The practices described earlier, abandoning the 10 non-virtues, identifying the scope and process of suffering, and the way beyond it through the Four Noble Truths, and adapting the monastic's detachment from transient pleasures to a layperson's life, all these create a necessary background for the second stage, what we call the morality of the great vehicle. Now, not only do you not harm others, but you carry more responsibility for helping them. Not harming others is a defensive practice, whereas the move to help others is proactive. Buddha teaches three stages of morality: the morality of individual liberation, the morality of concern for others, and the morality of Tantra. Helping others is the great vehicle teaching, the heart of the second stage, or bodhisattva morality. How can you cultivate this other concerned attitude? The main approach for orienting yourself toward caring is to consider your importance relative to others. A practice that traveled from India to Tibet involves first finding common ground with others, which is called equalizing, and then replacing your self-centeredness with other-centeredness, which is called switching. The Indian scholar yogi Shantideva explains this practice of equalizing and switching self and other thoroughly in his Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life, and many Tibetans have written commentaries on his text. Real compassion extends to each and every sentient being, not just to friends or family, or those in terrible situations. To develop the practice of compassion to its fullest extent, one must practice patience. Shantideva tells us that if the practice of patience really moves your mind and brings about a change, you will begin to see your enemies as the best of friends, even as spiritual guides. Enemies provide us with some of the best opportunities to practice patience, tolerance, and compassion. Shantideva gives us many marvelous examples of this in the form of dialogues between positive and negative aspects of one's own mind. His reflections on compassion and patience have been very useful in my own practice. Read them and your whole soul can be transformed. Here is an example. For a practitioner of love and compassion, an enemy is one of the most important teachers. Without an enemy, you cannot practice tolerance. Without tolerance, you cannot build a sound basis for compassion. So, in order to practice compassion, you should have an enemy. This is because when you face your enemy who is going to hurt you, that is the real time to practice tolerance. Therefore, an enemy is the cause of the practice of tolerance. Tolerance is the effect or result of an enemy. So those are cause and effect. As is said, once something has the relationship of arising from that thing, one cannot consider that thing from which it arises to be a harmer. Therefore, an enemy assists in the production of the effect, which is tolerance. Reflection on this type of reasoning can help develop great patience, which in turn develops powerful compassion. Real compassion is based on reason. Ordinary compassion or love is limited by desire or attachment. If your life is easy and everything is going smoothly, then you can maintain pretenses. However, when you face really desperate situations, there is no time to pretend. You have to deal with reality. Hard times build determination and inner strength. Through them, we can also come to appreciate the uselessness of anger. Instead of getting angry, nurture a deep caring and respect for those who make trouble. Because by creating such trying circumstances, they provide us with invaluable opportunities to practice tolerance and patience. My life has not been a happy time. I have had to pass through many difficult experiences, including losing my country to Chinese communist invaders and trying to reestablish our culture in neighboring countries. Yet I regard these difficult periods as among the most important times in my life. Through them, I have gained many new experiences and learned many new ideas. They made me more realistic. When I was young and living high above the city of Lhasa in the Botala Palace, I frequently looked at the life of the city through a telescope. I also learned a lot from the gossip of the sweepers in the palace. They were like my newspaper, relating what the regent was doing and what corruption and scandals were going on. I was always happy to listen, and they were even proud to be telling the Dalai Lama about what was happening in the streets. The harsh events that unfolded after the invasion in 1950 forced me to become directly involved in issues that otherwise would have been kept at a distance. As a result, I have come to prefer a life of committed social action in this world of suffering. The most difficult time for me was after the Chinese had invaded. I was trying to satisfy the invaders so that the situation would not worsen. When a small delegation of Tibetan officials signed a 17-point agreement with the Chinese without the consent of either myself or the government, we were left with no alternative but to attempt to work with the agreement. Many Tibetans resented it, but when they expressed their opposition, the Chinese reacted even more harshly. I was caught in the middle, trying to cool down the situation. The two acting prime ministers, on their own, complained about the conditions to the Chinese government. The Chinese government then asked me to dismiss them. This is the type of problem I had to face day by day as long as we were in Tibet. We could not concentrate on improving our own situation, but I did set up a reform committee to alleviate excessive charges of interest on debts and so forth. Against Chinese wishes, I first visited India in 1956 to celebrate the 2500th year after Buddha's birth. While in India, I had to make the difficult decision of whether to return to Tibet. I was receiving messages about open revolts in eastern Tibet, and many officials in Tibet advised me not to return. Also, from past experience, I knew that as China developed more military strength, their attitude would become more harsh. We could see that there was not much hope, but at that time it was not clear that we would have a full guarantee of effective support either from the government of India or from another government. In the end, we chose to return to Tibet. But in 1959, after there was a mass escape to India, my situation was easier because the dilemma was gone. We could put all of our energy and time into building a healthy community with modern education for the youth, and at the same time try to preserve our traditional ways of studying and practicing Buddhism. We were now working in an atmosphere of freedom without fear. My own practice has benefited from a life of great turbulence and trouble. You too can come to see the hardships you endure as deepening your practice. As Shantideva explains the practice of equalizing and switching self and other, first you realize that each and every sentient being wants happiness and does not want suffering, just like you. In this fundamental way, you and they are equal. Then, when you consider that you are only a single person, measured against an infinite number of other sentient beings, you realize that it would be completely ridiculous either to neglect the welfare of others or to use them for the sake of your own pleasure. It would be far more reasonable to dedicate yourself to their service. When you consider the situation this way, it becomes very clear. No matter how important you may be, you are only a single person. You have the same right to be happy as everyone else, but the difference is that you are one, and they are many. To lose the happiness of even a single person is important, but not so important as losing the happiness of many other beings. From this perspective, you can cultivate compassion, love, and respect for others. In a sense, all human beings belong to a single family. We need to embrace the oneness of humanity and show concern for everyone, not just my family or my country or my continent. We must show concern for every being, not just the few who resemble us. Differences of religion, ideology, race, economic system, social system, and government are all secondary. Put others first. You yourself come next. This works even from a selfish viewpoint. Let me explain how this is possible. First of all, you want happiness and do not want suffering. Then, if you show other people kindness, love, and respect, they will respond similarly with kindness, love, and respect. This way, your happiness will increase. But if you show other people anger and hatred, they will show you the same, and you will lose your own happiness. So I say, if you are selfish, you should be wisely selfish. Ordinary selfishness focuses only on your own needs. But if you are wisely selfish, you will treat others just as well as you treat those close to you. Ultimately, this strategy will produce more satisfaction, more happiness, even for yourself. So, from a selfish viewpoint, you get better results by respecting others, serving others, and reducing self-centeredness. When you are concerned about others, your own welfare is fulfilled automatically. Consider the physical and verbal non-virtues, these being the causes of being reborn in a bad situation. There are three types of outlooks that lead to avoiding killing, for instance. Someone with a small outlook avoids killing out of a motivation to not accumulate a bad karma imprinted in his or her own mind. Someone with a little broader perspective avoids killing by thinking that it will prevent rebirth in a good life where practice in order to leave the entire round of cyclic existence could be continued. However, altruistic people consider others' lives to be as important as their own, and they avoid murder out of wanting to protect the other person's life. This cherishing of others, therefore, makes a huge difference in the strength of the motivation to restrain from killing. Those whose motivation is self-centered could think that even if they commit such an ill deed, they could confess and seek to ameliorate the karma. However, someone who values another person's life cares about the other's suffering and knows that confessing to murder would not help that person. The same is true for stealing, adultery, lying, divisive talk, harsh speech, and even, I think, senseless chatter. Another way that other concern is so valuable is that it puts your own situation in perspective. At one point, I was particularly saddened about the situation of Tibet. But then I remembered that I had taken the Bodhisattva vows and every day had frequently reflected on Shantideva's prayer, "As long as the sky exists and as long as there are sentient beings, may I remain to help relieve them of all their pain." As soon as I remembered this, the whole feeling of burden immediately cleared away, much like heavy clothes being lifted off of me. Altruistic commitment relieves specific causes of dejection by placing them in a broader perspective. These causes should not discourage you. Most of one's own troubles, worries, and sadness in this life come from self-cherishing. As mentioned earlier, being wisely selfish is not negative, but short-sighted selfishness, concerned only with immediate satisfaction, is counterproductive. A narrow perspective makes even a small problem unbearable. Being concerned about all sentient beings widens your view, making you more realistic. In this way, an altruistic attitude helps to reduce your own pain right now. My earnest request is that you practice love and kindness whether you believe in a religion or not. Through this practice, you will come to realize the value of compassion and kindness for your own peace of mind. After all, even though you may not be concerned with other people, you are very much concerned with yourself, no question about it. So you must want to achieve a peaceful mind and a happier daily life. If you practice more kindness and tolerance, you will find more peace. There is no need to change the furniture in your house or move to a new home. Your neighbor may be very noisy or very difficult, but so long as your own mind is calm and peaceful, neighbors will not bother you much. However, if you are generally irritable, even when your best friend visits, you cannot become really happy. However, if you are calm, even your enemy cannot disturb you. This is why I say that if you are really selfish, you are better off being wisely selfish. This way you can fulfill your selfish motive to be happy. This is much better than being self-centered or foolishly selfish, which will not succeed. The following visualization technique is very helpful in daily practice. You remain calm and reasonable. In front of you to the right, imagine another version of yourself who is a solid mass of egotistical self-centeredness, the kind of person who would do anything to satisfy an urge. In front of you to the left, visualize a group of poor people who are not related to you, including some who are destitute, needy, suffering. Be calm and unbiased as you observe these two sides. Now think. Both want happiness. Both want to shed suffering. Both have the right to accomplish these goals. Consider this. We often work long and hard for a better salary, or we spend a great deal of money in hopes of gaining even more. We are willing to make temporary sacrifices for a long-term return. By the same logic, it makes perfect sense for one single person to make sacrifices in order to help a larger good. Naturally, your mind will favor the side with the greater number of suffering people. As an unbiased observer, observe your own egotistical self there at your right side, neglecting the welfare of so many, no matter how terrible their suffering. It simply is not good to be like this. Though both sides that you are visualizing have an equal right to happiness, there is no way to avoid the overwhelming need of the greater number. The point is that you yourself must serve and help other beings. This state of mind is undeniably difficult, but if you practice it with great determination, then year by year, your mind will change, will improve. In the mid-60s, I gave a teaching on Tsongkhapa's Stages of the Path to Enlightenment, during which I mentioned that if I achieved the first level of true cessation of afflictive emotions, I would take a long rest. I really felt that way. Even though I admired altruism, I thought it would be too difficult to develop. Then, around 1967, I received teaching on Shantideva's A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life from the Gagyu Lama Kunu Denzin Gyentsen and began to reflect more on its meaning along with Nagarjuna's precious garland. Eventually, I gained some confidence that with enough time, I could develop this high degree of compassion. Now, beginning from around 1970, every morning when I contemplate altruism, I cry. This is how transformation takes place. I do not claim to have developed a high degree of altruism, but I am confident that I can. Even if your experience of altruistic motivation is modest, it will definitely give you a degree of mental peace. Generating concern for others has vast powers to transform your mind. If you practice compassion for the sake of all living beings, including animals, then that same limitless merit will accrue to you. Even if you cannot, for the time being, rise to the level of cherishing others more than yourself, at least you can begin to see that it is not right to neglect others. We have a human body and the power of human judgment. But if we use these only for our own self-centered ends and not for the sake of others, we are no better than animals. In fact, ants, to cite just one example, work unselfishly for the community. We humans sometimes do not look good by comparison. We are supposed to be higher beings, so we must act according to our higher potentiality. If we look at world history, most great tragedies that involve terrible loss of life were brought about by human beings. Humans make the mess. Today, millions of people live in constant fear of racial, ethnic, and economic conflict. Who is responsible for this fear? Not animals. The consequences of war include the deaths of many animals. But this does not bother us. We are solely concerned with ourselves. There is much talk about stopping war, but we must go beyond wishful thinking. What is our human value when we live with no show of compassion, no show of concern, just killing and eating animals and fighting and killing thousands of people? It is our responsibility to clean up the mess. Nowadays, one of the best ways to communicate is through television. People who work in television and wish to practice this noble idea of caring for others could make a substantial contribution. Although stories of lust and murder provide exciting entertainment, they have negative influences deep in the mind. We do not need this kind of entertainment all the time, but this is probably none of my business. We must educate our young children in the practice of compassion. Teachers and parents can instill in children real, warm-hearted, human values to tremendous benefit. I noticed in a newspaper that a toy company, which usually makes toy rifles and so forth, deliberately stopped producing violent toys at Christmas. What a wonderful idea! What an other-centered act! Once you get to the point of deeply wanting to do whatever is possible to relieve suffering and uproot its causes, and to help all beings achieve happiness in its causes, reflect on how this could be brought about. It can only happen if other people also come to understand how this works, and then implement those practices. Therefore, your commitment to the highest welfare of other beings can best be supported by teaching them how to practice and what behavior to forsake, so that they themselves can have the power to attain happiness and avoid suffering. There is no other way. For this to happen, you yourself must know their inner dispositions and interests, as well as what to teach them. Thus, for the sake of helping others, you should be fully prepared. What is that preparation? You have to remove all obstacles in your mind to knowing everything that can be known. What compassionate practitioners, called bodhisattvas, really want is not just to overcome the obstructions which prevent their own liberation. They want to clear the way to omniscience so that they can gain access to other people's dispositions and discern which techniques will help them. If it were simply a matter of choice, the bodhisattvas would choose to remove the obstructions to omniscience first. However, the afflictive emotions, which keep us trapped in cyclic existence, are what establish the obstructions to omniscience, which are the predispositions in the mind causing phenomena to appear as if they are inherently existent. Therefore, without first overcoming the chief afflictive emotion, which is the ignorance that believes in inherent existence, you cannot overcome the predispositions deposited in the mind by that ignorance. Through purification of the afflictive obstructions as well as the predispositions established by them, you can transform your own consciousness into the omniscient consciousness of a Buddha. That is full enlightenment. To sum up, to bring about the complete happiness of others, it is necessary to become enlightened yourself. When you understand this and resolve to seek enlightenment for their sake, this is called the altruistic intention toward enlightenment, or bodhicitta. By following Shantideva's practice of seeing self and others as equally striving for happiness, and then switching the emphasis on your own aims over to those of infinite others, you can generate the power of bodhicitta within you. There are three different styles of altruistic attitude found in three types of people. The first is like a monarch, desiring to achieve Buddhahood first as the most effective way to help other beings. The second is like a boatman, desiring to arrive at the other shore of enlightenment together with all other beings. The third is like a shepherd, desiring that all others should achieve Buddhahood first before his or her own enlightenment. The last two analogies only indicate the compassionate attitude of certain types of practitioners. In actuality, there is no case like the boatman of everyone attaining enlightenment simultaneously, nor like the shepherd of everyone attaining enlightenment prior to oneself. Rather, enlightenment always comes in the first way, like a monarch, since bodhisattvas eventually decide to become enlightened as fast as possible so that they can more effectively help others on a vast scale. As the Tibetan sage Sakya Pandita says in his differentiation of the three vows, bodhisattvas have two kinds of wishes, those that can be accomplished and those that cannot. In Shantideva's A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, there are many examples of wishes that cannot actually be achieved, but are there for the sake of developing strong will and determination. For example, the practice of giving away your own happiness and taking the suffering of others upon yourself is not literally possible, except perhaps for minor forms of suffering. Just as this practice, though unrealistic, is intended to increase the courage of compassion, the analogies of the boatman and shepherd serve to indicate how powerfully certain bodhisattvas wish to help others. Let me give an example of this dedication that has been brought to the level of profound experience. There was a scholarly practitioner from the Dashikyo Monastery in the northeastern province of Tibet called Amdo. In 1950, when the Chinese communists invaded and arrested 1,000 out of 3,000 monks at the monastery, 100 of them were marked to be killed. He was one of them. Taken to the execution grounds, and just before being shot, he prayed, "May all the ill deeds, obstructions, and sufferings of beings be transferred to me without exception at this moment, and may my happiness and merit be sent to others. May all creatures be endowed with happiness." Just a few moments before being killed, he had the spiritual presence to remember the practice of taking on others' pain and giving away his own happiness. It's easy to talk about such practice when things are going well, but he was able to implement it at the hardest of times. This is a clear indication of spiritual attainment acquired from long practice. As Shantideva as a Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life says, if a blind person finds a jewel in a pile of garbage, she would cherish it dearly. If, in the midst of the garbage of lust, hatred, and ignorance, emotions that afflict our minds and our world, we generate a compassionate attitude, we should cherish this like a jewel. This precious discovery can give us happiness and real tranquility. Alternatives, such as taking a vacation or drugs, only bring temporary relief. A disciplined attitude of true other concern, in which you cherish others more than yourself, is helpful both to you and to others. It does no harm to anyone, temporarily or in the long run. Compassion is a priceless jewel. Care about others at all times. If you cannot help others, do no harm. This is the essential meaning of the practice of morality. Summary for daily practice. Perform the visualization in the 5 steps described earlier. 1. Remain calm and reasonable. 2. In front of you to the right, imagine another version of yourself, egotistical and self-centered. 3. In front of you to the left, imagine a group of poor people, suffering beings who are unrelated to you, neither friend nor enemy. 4. Observe these 2 sides from your calm vantage point. Now think, both want happiness, both want to get rid of suffering, both have the right to accomplish these goals. 5. Consider this. Just as usually we are willing to make temporary sacrifices for a greater long-term good, so too the benefit of the larger number of suffering beings to your left is much more important than this single, egotistical person on your right. Notice your mind naturally turning to the side of the greater number of people. Aspiring to enlightenment. Compassion is the key to achieving a deeper level of morality. Yet how can we help others when we ourselves are beset by wrong attitudes? Without being in a better position ourselves, it is difficult for us to help others on the large scale we have been discussing. For example, if you are going to help people who are illiterate, you have to be educated. Similarly, to help so many sentient beings, we must achieve Buddhahood, since a Buddha has all the qualities necessary to help them, knowledge of all the techniques for spiritual development, and clairvoyant knowledge of their emotions, interests, dispositions, and so forth. When you are moved through the practice of compassion to feel concern for others, it is time for new values to take root. We prepare the ground of our mind for these new values by engaging in the ritual for aspiring to enlightenment. You are already equipped with the basic qualities needed to attain complete enlightenment, the luminous and cognitive nature of your own mind. Therefore, focus on the thought, I will attain unsurpassed, perfect enlightenment for the sake of sentient beings throughout limitless space. Nurture this intention until it is strong. The ritual for aspiring to altruistic enlightenment is very helpful in this process. This ritual is preceded by the ritual called the Seven Meritorious Practices, which should become part of your daily meditation. These practices increase your force of merit, which in turn leads you more surely to transformation. Through these forms of devotion, you will intensify your commitment to compassion. As you'll see, they all involve paying devotion to those special beings who teach compassion. Homage is the first step. Imagine Shakyamuni Buddha surrounded by innumerable bodhisattvas filling the sky in front of you, and pay homage with your body, speech, and mind. Put your palms together and feel intensely that you are respectfully taking refuge in the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Say out loud, homage to Shakyamuni Buddha and the Bodhisattvas. The second step is offering. Spread out offerings, such as fruit or incense. Imagine everything that might be suitable to be offered, whether you own it or not, including your body, your resources, and your own virtue. Then imagine offering these in their entirety to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Third is to disclose ill deeds. We have all been responsible for countless ill deeds of body, speech, and mind motivated by the desire to do harm. In the spirit of full disclosure, develop a sense of regret for having done them, as if through those actions you had eaten poison. Generate, too, an intention to abstain from these actions in the future, as if to do otherwise might cost you your life. Think, from the bottom of my heart, I disclose to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas the ill deeds that I have done. The main way to purify bad deeds is through regret. The greater your regret, the stronger your intention not to repeat them in the future. Fourth, admiration. From the depths of your heart, admire your own virtuous actions and the virtuous actions of others. Take joy in the good things you have done in this lifetime. Focus on specific good deeds, such as giving to a charity. The fact that you have a human body in this lifetime and the opportunity to practice altruism is evidence of virtuous actions in past lives. So take joy in these virtues too, and think to yourself, I really did something good. Also take joy in the virtues of others, whether you have seen them firsthand or not. Beyond that, take joy in the innumerable virtues of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas over limitless time. By delighting in your own virtues and those of others, you will keep from regretting your own virtuous deeds, wishing you had not given to a charity because it caused your bank account to dwindle, for example. And you will also avoid becoming jealous of the good deeds of others, or competitive with them. The fifth step is entreaty. Ask the Buddhas who have become fully enlightened but have not yet engaged in teaching spiritual doctrine to do so on behalf of all who suffer. The sixth is supplication. Pray to the Buddhas not to pass away. This is a specific request for Buddhas who have taught and are nearing the time to pass away. You are asking them to remain teaching. The seventh and final step is dedication. Rather than directing your practice of the previous steps toward temporary happiness and comfort in this lifetime or the next, or to merely becoming liberated from cyclic existence. Dedicate that merit toward attaining highest enlightenment. Think, may these acts help me attain full and perfect enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. Then imagine that the entire world system has been purified, and offer it with all conceivable marvels to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. This special offering nourishes compassion by offering all things desirable to those who teach it. Now you are ready for the actual ritual of aspiring to enlightenment for the care of others. It comes in two parts. The first of these is the recitation of a short statement of refuge. It is, until I reach enlightenment, I seek refuge in Buddha, the doctrine, and the supreme spiritual community. In its most compassionate form, refuge is the union of three attitudes. The first is concern for the state of suffering of all beings, not just for yourself. Concern, too, that they not seek mere solitary relief from suffering, but aspire to the altruistic enlightenment of Buddhahood. The second attitude of refuge is faith in the Buddha, the states of realization, and the spiritual community, maintaining the conviction that through them all beings will find freedom from all suffering. Finally, the third attitude of refuge is compassion, which means not being able to stand the enslavement of others to suffering without doing something about it. Know that the Buddha is the teacher of refuge, that the true paths and true cessations are the actual refuge, and that the bodhisattvas who have directly realized the true nature of phenomena are our spiritual community, leading all sentient beings to refuge. With that knowledge, aspire to highest enlightenment by reciting, through the collections of merit of my giving, morality, patience, effort, concentration, and wisdom, may I achieve Buddhahood in order to help all beings. As you do this, think to yourself, through the force of these virtuous actions, may I achieve Buddhahood not to help myself, but to be of service to all sentient beings in order to help them reach Buddhahood. This is called generation of a compassionate intention to become enlightened in the form of a wish. This brings us to the central part of the ritual. With a strong wish to attain Buddhahood in order to serve other beings, imagine before you a Buddha or your own spiritual teacher as a representative of him. Recite the following as if you were repeating it after the Buddha. Until I reach enlightenment, I seek refuge in Buddha, the doctrine, and the supreme spiritual community. Through the collections of merit of my giving, morality, patience, effort, concentration, and wisdom, may I achieve Buddhahood in order to help all beings. By saying this, you are directing your virtuous actions not to some small purpose in this life or the next, but to the greatest purpose of all, the attainment of total freedom for all beings. Generate this attitude with great determination. Now, make this repetition with even stronger resolve to make this altruistic goal a constant in your day-to-day life. Until I reach enlightenment, I seek refuge in Buddha, the doctrine, and the supreme spiritual community. Through the collections of merit of my giving, morality, patience, effort, concentration, and wisdom, may I achieve Buddhahood in order to help all beings. Make the third repetition with even greater determination from the depths of your heart. Make a lasting, fully reasoned decision, unshakable by circumstance, that the welfare of so many others is far greater than your own. Think, now when I have such a great opportunity, what could be more important than striving for the benefit of others. From now on, to the full extent of my ability, I will stop concentrating on my own welfare and will commit myself deeply to the advancement of all beings. To accomplish this, I will achieve unsurpassed, perfect enlightenment. Recite. Until I reach enlightenment, I seek refuge in Buddha, the doctrine, and the supreme spiritual community. Through the collections of merit of my giving, morality, patience, effort, concentration, and wisdom, may I achieve Buddhahood in order to help all beings. This concludes the ritual. Through it, you plant and nurture the seeds of strong and unwavering compassion. There are four practices aimed at keeping this altruism from diminishing in this lifetime. First, increase your enthusiasm for becoming enlightened for the sake of others by recalling again and again the benefits of doing so, which were described earlier. Then, increase your concern for others by dividing the day and night into three periods each. And during those periods, take a little time from your day or rouse yourself from sleep to practice the five-step visualization described earlier, even for just 5 minutes. This practice is very effective. It becomes a regular habit, like eating food at a certain time. If you cannot do this so often, visualize the steps 3 times in one morning session that lasts around 15 minutes, and do the same at night. Ponder the meaning of your aim. May I attain highest enlightenment for others? The next practice requires vigilance. In seeking to gain highest enlightenment for the sake of all beings, make sure not to mentally neglect the welfare of even one. Try to accumulate the two forces of merit and wisdom as much as possible. To increase merit, engage willingly in virtuous activities like generosity and morality. To accumulate wisdom, you must come to understand the true way phenomena exist. Since this is a complicated topic, we will be exploring it at length later on. Suffice it to say here that it is helpful to reflect on how phenomena arise and exist dependent on causes and conditions. In future lifetimes, your compassionate intention to become enlightened could weaken. You can prevent this from happening by abandoning the 4 unwholesome activities and by training in the 4 wholesome practices that follow them. The 4 unwholesome practices are 1. Deceiving a high person, such as an abbot, ordination master, lama, or fellow practitioner, about negative things that you have done. 2. Causing others engaged in virtue to regret what they are doing. 3. Criticizing or belittling those who express compassion for others. And 4. Deceit and misrepresentation to get others' services. Here are the 4 wholesome practices. 1. Do not lie to anyone at all. There are exceptions, when lying can result in great benefit to others, but they are rare. 2. Help others move toward the altruistic enlightenment of Buddhahood, directly or indirectly. 3. Consider and treat bodhisattvas with the same respect as Buddha. Since we do not know who is and who is not a bodhisattva, we must treat all beings with respect. As a general rule, place others above you. And 4, never cheat anyone and always remain honest. If you have the resolve to train in these practices to generate a determination to achieve Buddhahood for others, then make this promise. I will maintain my determination and never give it up. Those who cannot maintain this level of training can forego the promise and instead can think, may I attain highest enlightenment for the sake of all beings. People who are not Buddhists, Christians, Jews, Muslims, and so forth, can generate an other-concerned attitude of equal value by thinking, I will bring about help and happiness for all beings. When your aspiration to become enlightened is firm, you should implement it in deeds. These are called bodhisattva deeds, and principal among them are the six perfections. Giving includes 1. Donating material things such as money, clothing, and food. 2. Giving love. 3. Giving the teachings of spiritual doctrines and practices. And 4. Giving relief from fearful situations to all beings, including animals. Help even an ant out of a puddle. Morality refers mainly to the altruistic attitude and behavior of bodhisattvas. Patience is exhibited in stressful situations or used to sustain difficult endeavors, such as learning teachings and practicing over a long period. Effort maintains enthusiasm for virtue and assists all the other perfections. Concentration is the practice of stable and intense meditation, which I will explain later. Wisdom is necessary for understanding the nature of cyclic existence and impermanence, as well as dependent arising and emptiness. The six perfections, in turn, can be condensed into the three trainings of bodhisattvas: training in the perfection of morality, which includes the perfections of giving and patience; training in the perfection of concentration; and training in the perfection of wisdom. The perfection of effort is required for all three trainings. This is how the six perfections are included in the threefold practice of morality, concentrated meditation, and wisdom that is the focus of this program. When you arrive at the feeling in the depths of your heart that you must engage in bodhisattva deeds, these being the six perfections, or, seen another way, the threefold practice of morality, concentrated meditation, and wisdom, this is the appropriate time to take the bodhisattva vows of the practical intention to become enlightened. In essence, all beings are united by the desire to gain happiness and avoid suffering. We are also the same in that it is possible to remove suffering and attain happiness, to which we all have an equal right. Then what is the difference between you and all others? You are a minority of one. It is easy to see that the vast number of sentient beings hoping for happiness and seeking an end to suffering are more important than any one person. It is therefore eminently reasonable for you to commit yourself to the welfare of innumerable others, to use your body, speech, and mind for their good, and to abandon an attitude of just taking care of yourself. Summary for daily practice. To attain enlightenment, practice compassion by taking the seven preliminary steps. 1. Pay homage to Shakyamuni Buddha, surrounded by innumerable bodhisattvas whom you imagine filling the sky before you. 2. Offer all wonderful things, whether you own them or not, including your body, your resources, and your own virtue, to the Buddhas and bodhisattvas. 3. Disclose the countless ill deeds of body, speech, and mind you have perpetrated with an intent to harm others. Regret having done them, and resolve to abstain from them in the future. 4. Admire from the depths of the heart your own virtues and those of others. Take joy in the good things you have done in this and previous lives, thinking, I have done something good. Also, take joy in the virtues of others, even including those of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. 5. Entreat the Buddhas who have become completely enlightened but have not yet taught to teach for the sake of those who suffer. 6. Supplicate the Buddhas not to pass away but to continue teaching. 7. Dedicate these 6 practices to attaining highest enlightenment. Then undertake the central part of the ritual for aspiring to enlightenment. 1. With a strong determination to attain Buddhahood in order to serve other beings, imagine a Buddha in front of you or your spiritual teacher as a representative of Buddha. 2. Recite 3 times as if you are repeating after him or her, until I reach enlightenment, I seek refuge in Buddha, the doctrine, and the supreme spiritual community. Through the collections of merit of my giving, morality, patience, effort, concentration, and wisdom, may I achieve Buddhahood in order to help all beings. To maintain and strengthen this profound altruism in this life, perform the following. 1. Recall again and again the benefits of developing an intention to become enlightened for the sake of others. 2. Divide the day into 3 periods and the night into 3 periods. And during each of those periods, take a little time out or rouse yourself from sleep and practice the 5-step visualization given earlier. It is also sufficient to visualize the 5 steps 3 times in 1 morning session that lasts around 15 minutes and 3 times in 1 night session for 15 minutes. 3. Avoid mentally neglecting the welfare of even 1 being. 4. As much as possible, engage in virtuous activity with a good attitude and develop a rough understanding of the nature of reality, or maintain a wish to do so and work at it. To maintain and strengthen this profound altruism in future lives, 1. Do not lie to anyone at all unless you can help others greatly through lying. 2. Directly or indirectly help people to progress toward enlightenment. 3. Treat all beings with respect. 4. Never cheat anyone and always remain honest. In essence, think again and again, may I become able to help all beings. Part 3. Practicing Concentrated Meditation, Focusing the Mind. Let us take a moment to review how progress toward a meaningful life unfolds. First comes morality, then concentrated meditation, then wisdom. Wisdom relies on the single-mindedness of meditation, and meditation depends upon the self-awareness of morality. Up until now, we have discussed the practice of morality, which makes you more settled and peaceful, and your mind ready for more spiritual advancement. With a conscious mode of behavior, concentrated meditation, called calm abiding, can be accomplished. Still, your mind is too scattered for increasingly effective meditative practice, which requires full concentration. Even a small noise here or there can immediately distract you. Since it is absolutely necessary to make the mind much more focused so that wisdom can take hold, I will now discuss the process of developing the profoundly concentrated state of calm abiding. First, I will briefly describe the various types of meditation so that you can understand the place that calm abiding takes among them. There are many ways to meditate. 2 basic types of meditation are analytical meditation and stabilizing meditation. In analytical meditation, you analyze a topic, trying to understand it through reasoning. For instance, you might meditate on why things are impermanent by reflecting on how they are produced by causes, or how they disintegrate moment by moment. In stabilizing meditation, you fix your mind on a single object or topic, such as impermanence. Calm abiding is cultivated through stabilizing meditation. Another way of dividing meditation is between subjective meditation and objective meditation. In subjective meditation, your aim is to cultivate in the mind a new or strengthened perspective or attitude. The cultivation of faith is an example of subjective meditation. Faith is not the object on which you are concentrating, but an attitude that is being meditatively cultivated. Cultivation of compassion, for instance, is subjective meditation because you are not meditating on compassion, but are seeking to make your consciousness more compassionate. In objective meditation, you meditate on a topic such as on impermanence, or on an object such as on the golden body of a Buddha. You can also meditate in the manner of wishing. For example, you might wish to be filled with the compassion and wisdom of a Buddha, and this wish would be your meditation. Or you can go one step further into imaginative meditation, in which you envision that you have qualities that you actually do not yet have. The practice of deity yoga, for example, calls for meditating on yourself as an ideal being whose body is made from the light of wisdom. Of these various forms of meditation, let us discuss how to practice the stabilizing meditation of calm abiding. As mentioned earlier, the aim of stabilizing meditation is to strengthen the mind's ability to focus on a single object or topic, which in turn enables the mind to overcome problems at their root. It will also help you to be more alert and sharp in daily life. It will gradually increase your power of memory, which is useful in all parts of your life. Since in this type of meditation, you are seeking to achieve a deeply concentrated state of mind, you need the following. First, you need the initial cause, morality, which brings you a peaceful, relaxed, conscientious mode of behavior and thus removes coarse distractions. Second, you need a time and place for practice apart from the commotion of daily life. Make time for meditation in your daily schedule. For focused meditation, being alone in a secluded, quiet spot is crucial. Since noise is the thorn preventing concentration, at the beginning, it is very important to stay in a quiet place. Consider taking a retreat instead of a vacation. 3. You need a suitable diet, fostering clarity of mind. For some health conditions, it may be necessary to eat meat, but generally speaking, vegetarian food is best. According to the morality of individual liberation, there is no prohibition against eating meat occasionally, but you should not eat meat that is purposely killed for you, and you should not ask for it if it is not offered. Indeed, it would be most welcome if the majority of people did become vegetarian. Some great vehicle scriptures prohibit the eating of meat, since concern for others is the heart of great vehicle morality. Also, eating too much food is not good, so eat less. Of course, drinking alcohol is out of the question, as are all mind-altering drugs. Smoking is not advisable. If a bearded man was smoking while entering into deep meditation, he would risk having his beard catch on fire. In addition, you need the right amount of sleep. Too much makes your mind dull, and too little can be disruptive. You have to figure out what the right amount is for you. Finally, physical posture is critical to focus meditation, especially at this early stage. If possible, assume the full or half lotus position. Use two cushions, putting a smaller one under your rear so that your rear is higher than your knees. The effect being that no matter how much you meditate, you will not be as likely to become tired. Straighten your backbone like an arrow. Bend your head just a little downward. Aim your eyes over the nose to the front. Put your tongue against the roof of the mouth. Leave your lips and teeth as usual. And leave your arms a little loose, not forcing them against the body. With regard to positioning the hands, Japanese Zen practitioners usually put the left hand palm up on top of the right, which is also palm up. Tibetans put the right hand palm up on top of the left, which is also palm up. In tantric practice, it is important to put the right hand on top of the left with both palms up and with the two thumbs pressed together in the form of a triangle, the base of which is about 4 finger widths below the navel. There are many possible objects of the stabilizing meditation for achieving calm abiding. One is the breath. Some texts speak of watching the inhalation and exhalation of breath through the nose, but do not address the topic of how deep to breathe. Other texts explain how to imagine the movement of breath in specific areas in the body. In one type of breathing exercise, you pull up the lower airs, or energies, and press down the upper energies, holding them as if in a vessel just below the navel. You can also use your body, or feelings, or mind, or phenomena such as impermanence as the object on which to perform stabilizing meditation. These meditations are called establishments through mindfulness. Or you can visualize the first letter of your name on a disc of light outside your body or inside your body. In Thailand, practitioners often meditate within applying mindfulness to whatever they do. While walking, they are mindful of putting the right foot forward, then the left, then the right. In general, a good object of meditation for a Buddhist is an image of the body of Shakyamuni Buddha. For a Christian, it could be an image of Jesus. Gaze at it to the point where it appears to your mind internally when you close your eyes. Meditate on the figure at eye level, not too high or low, at a distance of about 4 or 5 feet. At the beginning, it is difficult to get the object of meditation to appear clearly in your mind. To avoid dulling your perception, try frequent, intense, 5-minute sessions rather than long meditations. 4 to 16 of these brief sessions daily is ideal. When it finally appears internally, you have found your object of meditation. Now fix your mind continuously upon it. To achieve calm abiding, both stability and clarity are needed with respect to the object of meditation. Thus, the biggest obstacles to sustained meditation are excitement and laxity. Excitement prevents stability. When the mind does not stay in the object, but becomes distracted or scattered, the object of meditation is lost. There is also a subtle form of excitement where even if the object is not lost, a corner of the mind is thinking about something else. You need to identify excitement and through mindfulness, not let your mind come under its influence. Lethargy, a heaviness of mind and body, is an obstacle to clarity. Lethargy also causes laxity, which prevents clarity. In coarse laxity, the mind sinks. The object of meditation fades and is lost. In subtle laxity, the object is not lost, but the clarity of the object and the clarity of the mind diminish a little because the mind's intensity has weakened. The mind is a little too loose. The mind might stay quite clearly on the object of meditation, but without true alertness. This state is often mistaken for proper meditation. When your mind is too intense and you experience excitement, you need to loosen it, like loosening a bit the strings of a guitar. Similarly, when you have laxity, your mind is not intense enough. So you need to increase its intensity by making it a little more taut, like tightening the strings. As you can see, the mind needs to be tuned like a fine stringed instrument. The force behind developing concentrated meditation is mindfulness, which is the ability to stay with an object, not allowing distraction. You exercise mindfulness by putting your mind back on the object of meditation every time it falters, which will indeed happen again and again. When you become skilled in maintaining mindfulness on the object, you need to use introspection. As Shantideva's A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life says, the special function of introspection is periodically to inspect your activities, whether physical or mental. In the process of developing calm abiding, the task of introspection is to determine whether the mind has come or is about to come under the influence of laxity or excitement. At the start, periods of laxity and excitement are strong, but with effort, these become weaker and less frequent, and the periods of being able to stay on the object lengthen. Gradually, even subtle laxity and subtle excitement lose their force and disappear. Ultimately, the ability of the mind to stay one-pointedly on the object, free from the faults of excitement and laxity, increases. When, through mindfulness and introspection, you can sustain the continuum of holding the object, it is possible to achieve concentrated meditation even within 6 months. Initially, you must forcibly put your mind on the object of meditation with great exertion. Then, from time to time, you engage the object without great exertion. Then, you engage it in a relaxed way continuously. And finally, you spontaneously stay on the object without needing to make any effort to remove excitement and laxity. If you are able to remain on your object for 4 hours vividly and continuously, you have achieved firm stability. Unfavorable states of body and mind are gone, and a bliss of physical and mental pliancy is attained. At that point, you have achieved calm abiding. To be endowed with calm abiding, the mind must have the stability to hold fast to one object. But this alone is not sufficient. The mind must also be clear. But this too is not enough. Its clarity should be intense, alert, and sharp. The mind cannot be even a little dull. These fine adjustments to the mind that make it susceptible to calm abiding are not easily accomplished. In Dharamsala, India, one of the Tibetans practicing concentrated meditation, told me that the cultivation of one-pointed concentration was worse than imprisonment in a Chinese jail. Because it is difficult, it is important to prepare carefully, moving from step to step. Do not push yourself too hard, especially at first. Otherwise, you run the risk of becoming upset or even having a nervous breakdown. The goal here is daily practice, where you choose an object of meditation, and as you focus on it, try to achieve and maintain stability, clarity, and intensity. Calm abiding can also be achieved through daily meditations on the mind itself. One of the advantages of observing the mind now is that it will strengthen your ability to manifest the mind of clear light as you are dying. First, identify the mind's essential nature of luminosity and knowing, unsullied by thought, and then concentrate on it. This is one among many levels of thoughtlessness. I will describe meditation on the ultimate nature of the mind later. To prepare for concentrating on the mind itself, you need to overcome emotional obstacles by engaging in the accumulation of positive merit, such as through developing compassion, as discussed earlier. The next step is to become familiar with the nature of your own mind. The best time for this is early in the morning, just after waking, but before all your sense faculties have become active. Your eyes are not yet open. Look at or within consciousness itself. This is a good opportunity to experience the clear light nature of the mind. Do not let your mind think on what has happened in the past, nor let it chase after things that might happen in the future. Rather, leave the mind vivid, without any constructions, just as it is. In the space between old and new ideas, discover the natural, unfabricated, luminous, and knowing nature of the mind, unaffected by thought. When you remain this way, you understand that the mind is like a mirror, reflecting any object, any conception, and that the mind has a nature of mere luminosity and knowing, of mere experience. After you recognize the nature of the mind as luminosity and knowing, stay with it. Using your powers of mindfulness and introspection, remain in that state. If a thought comes, just look into its very nature, and the concept will lose its power and dissolve of its own accord. Sometimes, through exertion, you can prevent a thought from fully forming. More likely, though, when you reach this state of recognizing the basic, unaffected, unfabricated nature of the mind, thoughts will dissolve as soon as they form. And even when they do come, they will not be powerful. Know that just as the waves of the ocean are made of water, thoughts are made of the luminous, knowing nature of the mind. And through continual daily practice, thoughts will weaken and disappear without any other exertion. This practice of meditation itself sharpens your mind and improves your memory, qualities that are certainly useful beyond spiritual practice, whether in business, engineering, raising a family, or being a teacher, doctor, or lawyer. This practice also helps on a daily basis with anger. When you get irritated, you can concentrate on the nature of the anger itself and thereby undermine its force. Another benefit of such mental training emerges from the close connection between body and mind. When you are young and physically fit, your mind is powerful. It is particularly valuable to begin training then, so that as you age, your mind stays fresh and positive through the body's changes. After all, the human brain is a special endowment, and it would be a pity to let it weaken through neglect, surrendering its powers to age until, animal-like, its only job is to take care of the body. For practitioners, early mental training, and especially concentration on the mind, is important preparation for the final day, when your mind must remain clear and sharp to make use of the special techniques during the stages of death, or at least to influence rebirth into the next life. Dullness of mind at this critical point can be very dangerous. A real guarantee for a good rebirth is to be able to conduct your practice during the stages of dying. Your state of mind just before rebirth is influential in determining the character of your next life. You may have accumulated great merit in your life, but if you leave it with a dull mind, you jeopardize the form your next life will take. On the other hand, even if you committed some regrettable deeds in your lifetime, when the final day comes, if you are prepared and determined to use that occasion to the fullest, your next rebirth will definitely be good. Therefore, strive to train the mind to be fresh, alert, and sharp. In difficult situations, it is easy to become emotionally worked up. Buddhism offers many techniques for relieving stress and finding calm in the trying situations we face every day. These techniques vary according to the situation and the person. It is particularly effective to use the power of analytical meditation to address problems directly rather than trying to avoid them. Here are some examples of this technique. When you are confronted with trouble, do whatever you can to overcome it. But if it is insurmountable, then reflect on the fact that this trouble is due to your own actions in this or a previous life. Understanding that suffering comes from karma will bring some peace as it reveals that life is not unjust. Otherwise, sorrow and pain might seem to be meaningless. Initially, a problem can seem solid and intractable until you investigate its true nature. To do this, work at understanding the range of suffering in your own life. Ordinary mind and body have a nature of suffering, just as it is the nature of fire to be hot and burning. In the same way we have learned how to work with the nature of fire, we can learn how to work with suffering in our own lives. Consider trouble from a broader perspective. If someone accuses you, rather than lashing back, imagine that this accusation loosens the chains of your own self-cherishing and thereby enhances your ability to care for others. Reframe bad circumstances as forces assisting your spiritual development. This technique is difficult to implement, but very powerful when you succeed. When you are jealous or wish harm on an enemy, instead of stewing over that person's bad qualities, reflect on his or her good attributes. Most people are a mixture of good and bad qualities. It is hard to find anyone who is bad in all respects. Reflect on the emptiness of inherent existence. This is the deepest analytical meditation and something I will explore shortly. Or you can use stabilizing meditation for a temporary rest. If you cannot stop worrying over something in the past or what might happen in the future, shift your focus to the inhalation and exhalation of your breath. Or recite this mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. Since the mind cannot concentrate on two things simultaneously, either of these two stabilizing meditations will cause the former worry to fade. It seems to me that all religions could benefit from Buddhist meditation techniques. Single-minded concentration could be applied usefully in many situations. In all walks of life, we can benefit from focusing the mind and increasing memory. Summary for daily practice. Choose an object of meditation and focus your mind on it. Try to achieve and maintain stability, clarity, and intensity. Avoid laxity and excitement. Alternatively, identify the fundamental state of the mind, unsullied by thought, in its own state, mere luminosity, the knowing nature of the mind. With mindfulness and introspection, remain in that state. If a thought arises, just look into the very nature of that thought. This will cause it to lose its power and dissolve of its own accord. Part 4, Practicing Wisdom, Examining How Beings and Things Exist. To generate the type of love and compassion that motivates you to seek Buddhahood, not for yourself, but for the sake of others, first you must confront suffering by identifying its types. This is the first noble truth. From the time we are born to the time we die, we suffer mental and physical pain, the suffering of change, and the pervasive suffering of uncontrolled conditioning. The second and third noble truths lead us to understand the causes of suffering and whether or not those causes can be removed. The fundamental cause of suffering is ignorance, the mistaken apprehension that beings and objects inherently exist. Now, as I will show, beings and objects do not, in fact, exist this way. We all have a valid, proper sense of self, or I, but then we additionally have a misconception of that I as inherently existing. Under the sway of this delusion, we view the self as existing under its own power, as established by way of its own nature, as able to set itself up. This sense of inherent existence can even be so strong that the self feels independent from mind and body. For instance, if you are weak from sickness, you might feel you could switch bodies with someone who is stronger. Similarly, when your mind is dull, you might feel you could switch your mind with someone else's sharp mind. However, if there were such a separate I, self-established and existing in its own right, it should become clearer and clearer under competent analysis as to whether it exists as either mind or body, or as the collection of mind and body, or as different from mind and body. In fact, the closer you look, the more it is not found. This turns out to be the case for everything, for all phenomena. The fact that you cannot find them under such analysis means that those phenomena do not exist under their own power. They are not self-established. Sometime during the early 60s, when I was reflecting on a passage by Tsongkhapa about unfindability and the fact that phenomena are dependent on conceptuality, it was as if lightning coursed within my chest. Here is the passage from Tsongkhapa's text. A coiled rope's speckled color and coiling are similar to those of a snake. And when the rope is perceived in a dim area, the thought arises, this is a snake. As for the rope, at that time when it is seen to be a snake, the collection and parts of the rope are not even in the slightest way a snake. Therefore, that snake is merely set up by conceptuality. In the same way, when the thought I arises in dependence upon mind and body, nothing within mind and body, neither the collection, which is a continuum of earlier and later moments, nor the collection of the parts at one time, nor the separate parts, nor the continuum of any of the separate parts, is in even the slightest way the I. Also, there is not even the slightest something that is a different entity from mind and body that is apprehendable as the I. Consequently, the I is merely set up by conceptuality in dependence upon mind and body. It is not established by way of its own entity. The impact of my reflection on this statement lasted for a while, and for the next few weeks, whenever I saw people, they seemed like a magician's illusions, in that they appeared to inherently exist, but I knew that they actually did not. That experience, which was like lightning in my heart, was most likely at a level below completely valid and incontrovertible realization. This is when my understanding of the cessation of the afflictive emotions as a true possibility became real. Nowadays, I always meditate on emptiness in the morning and bring that experience into the day's activities. Just thinking or saying I, as in, I will do this, will often trigger the feeling. But still, I cannot claim full understanding of emptiness. A consciousness that conceives of inherent existence does not have a valid foundation. A wise consciousness, grounded in reality, understands that beings and other phenomena, minds, bodies, buildings, and so forth, do not inherently exist. This is the wisdom of emptiness. Understanding reality exactly opposite to the misconception of inherent existence, wisdom gradually overcomes ignorance. Remove the ignorance that misconceives phenomena to inherently exist, and you prevent the generation of afflictive emotions like lust and hatred. Thus, in turn, suffering can also be removed. In addition, the wisdom of emptiness must be accompanied by a motivation of deep concern for others, and by the compassionate deeds that that compassion inspires. This is necessary before wisdom can remove the obstructions to omniscience, which are the predispositions for the false appearance of phenomena, even to sense consciousnesses, as if they inherently exist. Therefore, full spiritual practice calls for cultivating wisdom in conjunction with great compassion and the intention to become enlightened, in which others are valued more than yourself. Only then may your consciousness be transformed into the omniscience of a Buddha. Both Buddhists and non-Buddhists practice meditation to achieve pleasure and get rid of pain. And in both Buddhist and non-Buddhist systems, the self is the central object of scrutiny. Certain non-Buddhists who accept rebirth accept the transitory nature of mind and body, but they believe in a self that is permanent, changeless, and unitary. Although Buddhist schools accept rebirth, they hold that there is no such solid self. For Buddhists, the main topic of the training in wisdom is emptiness or selflessness, which means the absence of a permanent, unitary, and independent self, or, more subtly, the absence of inherent existence, either in living beings or in other phenomena. To understand selflessness, you need to understand that everything that exists is contained in two groups called the two truths, conventional truths and ultimate truths. The phenomena that we see and observe around us can go from good to bad or bad to good, depending on various causes and conditions. Many phenomena cannot be said to be inherently good or bad. They are better or worse, tall or short, beautiful or ugly, only by comparison, not by way of their own nature. Their value is relative. From this, you can see that there is a discrepancy between the way things appear and how they actually are. For instance, something may, in terms of how it appears, look good, but due to its inner nature being different, it can turn bad once it is affected by conditions. Food that looks so good in a restaurant may not sit so well in your stomach. This is a clear sign of a discrepancy between appearance and reality. These phenomena themselves are called conventional truths. They are known by consciousness that goes no further than appearances. But the same objects have an inner mode of being called an ultimate truth that allows for the changes brought about by conditions. A wise consciousness, not satisfied with mere appearances, analyzes to find whether objects inherently exist as they seem to do, but discovers their absence of inherent existence. Such a wise consciousness finds an emptiness of inherent existence that is beyond appearances. Emptiness or selflessness can only be understood if we first identify that of which phenomena are empty. Without understanding what is negated, you cannot understand its absence, emptiness. You might think that emptiness means nothingness, but it does not mean nothingness. Merely from reading, it is difficult to identify and understand the object of negation, what Buddhist texts speak of as true establishment or inherent existence. But over a period of time, when you add your own investigations to the reading, the faultiness of our usual way of seeing things will become clearer and clearer. Buddha said many times that because all phenomena are dependently arisen, they are relative. Their existence depends on other causes and conditions, and depends as well on their own parts. A wooden table, for instance, does not exist independently. Rather, it depends on a great many causes, such as a tree, the carpenter who makes it, and so forth. It also depends upon its own parts. If a wooden table or any phenomenon really were not dependent, if it were established in its own right, then when you analyze it, its existence in its own right should become more obvious, but it does not. This Buddhist reasoning is supported by science. Physicists today keep discovering finer and finer components of matter, yet they still cannot understand its ultimate nature. Understanding emptiness is even deeper. The more you look into how an ignorant consciousness conceives phenomena to exist, the more you find that phenomena do not exist that way. However, the more you look into what a wise consciousness understands, the more you gain affirmation in the absence of inherent existence. Lust and hatred are ruled by ignorance, and so cannot be generated limitlessly. Since, as we have established, when any phenomenon is sought through analysis, it cannot be found, you may be wondering whether these phenomena exist at all. However, we know from our own direct experience that people and things cause pleasure and pain, and that they can help and harm. Therefore, phenomena certainly do exist. The question is how they exist. They do not exist in their own right, but only have an existence dependent upon many factors. including a consciousness that conceptualizes them. Once they exist, but do not exist on their own, they necessarily exist in dependence upon conceptualization. However, when phenomena appear to us, they do not at all appear as if they exist this way. Rather, they seem to be established in their own right, from the object's own side, without depending upon a conceptualizing consciousness.